On this week's 51%, we hear from a woman about the effects evangelical Christianity's purity culture has had on a generation of young women.
The breakthrough was when I realized that I wasn't alone, because that meant that I wasn't the problem.
And hear how a big piece of reversing global warming lies with women. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. So we prayed with many different gods as there are flowers, but we call religion our friend. We're so worried about saving our souls, afraid that God will take his toll, that we forget to begin. But who will save your soul when it comes to the bells now? Oh, oh, I'll save your soul. In the 1990s, a purity industry emerged out of the white evangelical Christian culture. Purity rings, purity pledges, and purity balls came with a dangerous message. Girls are potential sexual stumbling blocks for boys and men, and any expression of a girl's sexuality could reflect the corruption of her character. This message traumatized many girls, resulting in anxiety, fear, and experiences that mimicked the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and trapped them in a cycle of shame. Linda K. Klein is the author of Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. She discusses the book with 51%'s Joe Donahue.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to write this story, to tell your story and what happened to you?
You know, in my early 20s, for a long time, I felt like there was something really wrong with me because I had left evangelicalism and I had rejected the sexual shame that I had been raised with in my religious community and thought that I would be free at that point from shame. You know, I had stepped away from the community that was shaming me. I had wrestled with it. I was in a better place, I was sure. But then I started to realize how deep the shame lived inside of me. I no longer needed external shamers. I was more than capable of shaming myself now. And, you know, I felt incredibly alone. I felt broken. I felt fearful that I would never be healthy and never have a healthy relationship. And it wasn't until I started to call up the girlfriends that I had been raised with in my evangelical Christian church and telling them what I was experiencing that I, you know, started to realize I wasn't alone, because my jaw just dropped as I sat and listened to them share stories that were remarkably similar to my own, stories of sexual fear and shame and anxiety that were sometimes manifesting in ways that were physical, that were really mimicking the symptoms of classic PTSD. And that realization that I wasn't alone was so important that it kicked off a 12-year journey in which I've been interviewing people around the country. And that really is the inspiration for the book, so that other people know that they aren't alone without necessarily having to go on a 12-year journey to get there.
Growing up in the American Evangelical Christian Church, tell us a little bit about that upbringing in the church and how ultimately when it started, when you started to get these particular teachings that you're talking about in Pure.
Sure. You know, there was so much that I loved about growing up in the church, to be completely honest with you. So this wasn't the only message that I received there. But this is certainly one of the messages that I received, this teaching that there were two types of girls and women, those who were pure and those who were impure. And girls could be considered impure based on their own sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors, but also based on the sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors of men in the community toward them, which girls and women are said to have inspired because of how they dress or how they walk or how they talk. And it just creates a tremendous amount of anxiety. You know, I experienced, you know, a constant state of fear because you never were quite sure what it was you were going to do that was going to be considered, you know, wrong enough that someone would pull you aside and accuse you of being impure, which is no small thing in that community.
So when it comes to the actual teachings, and especially when it comes to sexual ethics, this is ingrained in you at a very young age, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I actually joined the evangelical church when I was 13, so I joined at the age when people were really getting the heaviest dose of this. However, this is something that, you know, is part of the culture and that I think is a message that people get from their very earliest ages. But you really start to see the work of the purity movement and of the purity industry as people enter junior high. So when I came into the church at the age of 13 with the absolute fervor of a convert, you know, somebody who was just completely sold out for Jesus, if you will, that to use terminology from the culture, you know, this was a big part of the messaging that I received.
How did you see it and how do you see it now as an industry?
So in the early 1990s, that's when you really started to see the rise of the industry. So that's when we started to see a lot of purity rings and purity pledges and purity balls and purity curricula and purity videos and perhaps, you know, most notably, purity-themed Bibles. So imagine you have a Bible and, you know, 60 pages of it is non-biblical material that's completely dedicated to the importance of your remaining, quote, sexually pure. You know, with advice like avoid the horizontal. That's about a sixth of your Bible. So it's very difficult, as you can imagine, to grow up in that culture and not think that your sexuality and your salvation are, you know, inextricable.
So for you, it manifested itself in many ways. You write that you took pregnancy tests even though you had not had sex.
Yeah, it's such a perfect illustration of the amount of anxiety that I was experiencing. You know, I wasn't having sex, but I was being sexual. And, you know, I had been trained that girls who are sexual, and at this point I was a young woman, I was in my early 20s, that, you know, women who are sexual outside of marriage are going to have horrible things happen to them. And I sort of waited in this anticipation of the sky, you know, falling. And the way in which it seemed most likely that the sky might fall, or at least most horrible that the sky might fall, is that I would become pregnant and that my sin would be exposed to the community I had left but was still desperately seeking to approve of me. And so I ended up taking pregnancy tests just to steady my breathing, just to calm myself down. And I felt really like that didn't make sense. You know, I was a smart girl. I understood that you don't get pregnant if you don't have sex. And yet the anxiety was still there. And that's something that later when I started doing interviews, you know, starting in my hometown and then around the country, I heard again and again from people. I remember the first time that I heard someone tell me that they had taken pregnancy tests, though they weren't having sex, I was shocked that I wasn't the only one. But, you know, I've since heard that story so many times, you know, and many more like it, you know, these manifestations that don't make sense, but that's really how extreme the fear and anxiety goes in us.
You just used the term the community I left. When did you leave that community?
I left in my early 20s before I started to actually have these experiences. So it really, you know, when I first left in my early 20s, left the evangelical church, though to be clear, I'm still very much a Christian and, you know, my faith is a huge part of my life to this day. When I left the evangelical subculture, you know, I had purposefully rejected the shame-based messaging that I've been raised with. And really, you know, thought that was going to be it. And then that's when I really started to see how deeply it went inside of me, because I realized that though my spirit and my mind, you know, was in one place, my body had been deeply trained to be somewhere else. And really, it created this war inside of me where, you know, my body wouldn't do what I wanted it to do. You know, it was breaking down into tears. I was having my eczema, which flares when I get stressed out, come out and scratching myself until I bled. I was so full of anxiety over something that intellectually I didn't think I should have anxiety around.
When did you start to identify it? Identify it as a PTSD-like experience?
I didn't call it that until I started talking to other people and hearing the same things from them long enough that things just fit into those categories. You know, people are having reactions to their own bodies, to seeing their voluptuous body in the mirror, to having sexual thoughts or feelings, to having sexual experiences. You know, they're having physical reactions that sometimes are so intense that they are actually panic attacks. And not only that, but people also have those same reactions, some people, to being in church. You know, I've heard so many people tell me stories about how they walk into a church and they break into uncontrollable tears and they can't tell you why. All they know is that, you know, they feel in their gut that something traumatic happened to them there, though they can't point to anything traumatic that happened to them. But you know what happened is that they were deeply shamed there. And shame, you know, is held in the body, research tells us, in a very similar way to trauma. So it really makes sense when we have been shamed repetitively, you know, that it starts to live so deep inside of us that later when that shame is triggered, be it by our bodies or by our sexuality, or even by walking into a place in which we've experienced repetitive shaming like the church, that there would be these physical triggers that would be a natural next step.
When it comes to your own healing, give us a sense of that timeline, and also what ultimately was the breakthrough for you?
The breakthrough was when I realized that I wasn't alone, because that meant that I wasn't the problem. You know, that meant that the problem was what I was taught, was what we were taught. So I essentially, over the course of those 12 years of interviews, put myself through narrative therapy, you know, first starting in my hometown and then with people around the country. I told my story over and over and over again, and then I listened to my story told back to me in the stories of other people, the details being different, but the core messages of sexual shame and fear and anxiety being the same. And that experience of story exchange is how I really healed, because the more that I heard my story be told back to me, the more that I could say, okay, the problem is outside of me. The problem is something that, yes, I've internalized, but it is something that I can look at and I can point to and I can name, and now I can deal with in a way that I couldn't before when I just thought it was my own brokenness. And so really, I've come to believe that that's the only way we can break free, that we don't break free alone, that we only break free together. Mm-hmm. Which is why we're starting a new hashtag, actually, called Break Free Together, so that people can share their stories online and find one another so we can start to do this healing work as a community.
You read about this in the book, but there is a prescription here, you believe, that there are ways for churches to teach sexual health and sexual ethics in a more positive way.
Absolutely. And there are some evangelical churches that are using these methods that I do highlight in the book that I think can offer guideposts for many churches. One that I really love is a curriculum called OWL, Our Whole Lives. And it's a really tremendous curriculum that really looks at sexuality education across the lifespan. So they have, you know, curriculum that starts with around kindergarten, and then now they're developing some for folks who are in the retirement age. So they really are trying to meet people where they're at across the lifespan and give them developmentally appropriate information at each age. So when you're talking to a kindergartner, you're not talking to them about sex, but you're talking to them about how you should be treated, how you should expect your friends to treat you, how you should treat your friends. You know, what is yours? Your body is your own. Different things like that, that ultimately, as you move forward over the course of the years, you have a value set that you've taught young people and that you've taught them that they can use to make decisions around their relationships and their bodies that in time they can see can be used, you know, over the course of their lives.
And if the decision is to have sex as a teenager before marriage, then what is the judgment call?
Then what is the judgment?
Yes.
Oh, in the community, you mean?
Yes. In this education model, if someone is to have sex...
In the OWL model.
Yes.
Got it. So the OWL model is really a values-based model. So they're not giving any hard and fast rules. They're not saying, you know, you should do this or you shouldn't do that. Really what they're doing is they're teaching people to identify a set of values and to learn how to make decisions around them. In the same way that we teach people to make, you know, values-based financial decisions or values-based decisions on food. We don't teach people to not eat anything or to eat everything in sight. We teach them how to have healthy relationship with food. So that's what this model teaches. It teaches people how to make healthy decisions. Now, the curriculum creators would say that they would recommend that people aren't having sex at a young age, particularly when people are, you know, early in high school. But they're not making hard judgment calls. They're really trying to teach young people how to come to conclusions on their own in safe, healthy, values-based ways.
That was Linda K. Klein, author of Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. She was speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. Nonprofit organization Project Drawdown has an educational initiative called Project Learn that brings forward a solutions-based approach to climate change. The initiative is based on the New York Times bestseller, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Paul Hawken edited the book that maps, measures, models, and describes the 100 most substantive solutions to global warming. Hawken says the top solutions come as a surprise to many.
And in terms of solutions, what I think what happened is we all have a bias. A bias means we've heard a lot of information, news, and we think we know what we ought to do, at least the most important things. And we hear from, you know, like Al Gore and others, you know, it's like solar and wind and Elon Musk, you know, as if we did all those three things, you know, we'd get a hall pass to the 22nd century and everything would be cool. And that's just a scientific howler. And those are crucial solutions, don't get me wrong, they're absolutely crucial. And so, because nobody had ever measured and modeled the 100 most substantive solutions. And if I had been asked if I had been asked to say what were the top 5 or 10 solutions, I would have written them down like that, and I would have been completely wrong.
He and Al Gore, so what are the top solutions?
Nobody's ever questioned the math. Since the book has been out for 18 months. And yet the number one solution is refrigerant management. The number three solution is reduced food waste. The number four is, you know, plant-rich diet. The number six solution is educating girls. And people are going, what? I mean, wind was 2, give it that, but then solar is 10. You know, I mean, it was very different than what we've been taught to believe. Because it is, that's belief. And we say, you know, people say, well, the book is so hopeful. We said, no, that wasn't our intention whatsoever. It is a reality project. It was all about reality, science, grounded.
Hawken expands on educating girls.
And actually, I put that in as in the hat because we had to winnow everything out and decide what actually did make sense to model. And some of our researchers sort of just brushed it away, you know, said, oh, what are you talking about? But what we know about girls is that they're yanked out of school pre or at puberty for two reasons, basically early marriage or to go to work so the brothers can go to school. I mean, there's really the only two reasons. So basically, those decisions are made for them, not by them, and they... we know that they have about 5+ children, that their health is imperiled by having early pregnancy. We know that they're impoverished almost without exception because they don't have an education, they don't get good jobs, they have too many children. The health outcomes for both the children and the mother are at risk. They don't have the resources to address those health outcomes, and that tends to repeat itself. Those children repeat their mothers and behavior. And if a girl is supported to become a woman more or less, but a lot more on her terms by finishing school, she makes a very different decisions for her life. And she has 2+ children, which is replacement rate, just over 2. She's better educated, she earns more money, she puts more resources into her children. Those children repeat their mother's behavior and pattern in terms of reproduction rates. And not only that, but those women are very, very instrumental in terms of resilience, climate resilience, in terms of making their villages or towns or cities a better place. I mean, they're huge contributors to problems that we all face. And so that's the number 6 solution. The number 7 solution is family planning. And family planning is to actually provide, you know, it's not in Africa, it's here in the United States and every place else, the capacity and ability for women to take care of their reproductive health and well-being in their families. And that is a right. And but actually, girls' education is another pathway to family planning. But it's not about planning. It's about empowering a girl to be educated on her terms so that she decides herself what is sensible for her. If you add up number 6 and number 7, there to nerd out here, 59.6 gigatons of CO2 avoided, emissions avoided, which is 119.2 together, gigatons, it's the number one solution to reversing global warming is the empowerment of girls and women. And you might ask, well, why don't we know that? Or you could say, how do we know that at Drawdown? We know that from the UN. It's right there. All our numbers come from the UN. We know that there's high and median population figures for 2050 from the UN, 10.8 or 9.7 billion, and the UN is very clear about it, and the difference is access to family planning and supporting girls' education. So again, drawdowns reflecting back to the world what we know, but we don't know, if you know what I mean. It's not that, that knowledge is not evident and commonplace. And so, and I think it's because so much of the climate movement, climate change, has been brought about by men scientists. And so there's a tendency to look at Promethean solutions, big solar farms and big wind turbines, bigger than the Eiffel Tower. Good on you. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm just saying it's that in the process, you know, this idea of women have rarely been excluded. And, you know, we have women smallholders. I can talk about that too if you like. But
please.
I mean, well, women smallholders, a smallholder defined by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN is somebody with 2 hectares or less of land or 5 acres. And 70% of the food in the world is produced by smallholders. And 28% is produced by big ag. If you listen to all the whining and, you know, of big ag, they say unless we have GMOs and pesticides and our, you know, mineral fertilizers and all that sort of stuff, that the world is going to starve. And, you know, so let us loose and, you know, we know what we're doing and, you know, otherwise you won't have food. Well, that's just not true. Because what they produce primarily is corn and soy for pigs and cows, all right? And then they produce sugar and white flour and hydrogenated fats. And so basically big ag produces big pharma, which is stroke, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, etc. That's what they're producing. Meanwhile, 70% of the food in the world is produced by smallholders. And of that, 40 to 43%, depending on the continent, are women. So if you do the math, women produce more food in the world today than big ag. It's like, again, who knew? Why do we know that? You know, it's not, you know, Monsanto and Bayer and, you know, DuPont and Syngenta. It's women. And why is it in drawdown? It's because if women get the same support that men get as smallholders, seeds, training, tools, okay, those three things, they outproduce men 10 to 20%. And so if we give that support to women smallholders, then the impact on avoided deforestation is huge in the world. And so again, when you look at global warming, you look at it from a objective, but point of view and say, okay, where are the impacts? What are the causes? What are the cures? What are the solutions? You come up with a very, very different way of seeing the world, and it's transformative.
That was Paul Hawken, founder of Project Drawdown. North Korean refugees say sexual violence against women in their former homeland is part of daily life. But a new report suggests there's little chance that abused women in the North will get to say Me Too anytime soon. North Korea's highly patriarchal society means many women feel powerless to demand accountability over sexual violence. Many are also ashamed of being abused, and some choose to keep silent because of flimsy law enforcement and support systems. This is according to a report recently published by Human Rights Watch. Based on interviews with 106 North Koreans who left the country, more than half of them after 2011. The UN Security Council has authorized action against illicit oil exports from Libya until February 2020 and added planning and committing sexual and gender-based violence as reasons for sanctions, despite objections from Russia and China. The November 5th vote in the United Nations' most powerful body was 13-0, with Russia and China abstaining. The Netherlands and Sweden pushed for including planning, directing, or committing acts involving sexual and gender-based violence as criteria for sanctions, citing the increasingly worrying problem in Libya, especially against migrants trying to reach Europe. Russia's UN ambassador said Moscow objected to sexual and gender-based violence being included in a resolution dealing with threats to international peace and security, saying those issues are considered at the Human Rights Council and the Commission on the Status of Women. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1530.